Hello, everybody. Welcome to Talk Now Radio. Listener supported radio, where no topic is taboo. We're brought to you by Revolution Radio. Also, listener supported radio, where information never sleeps. And today, I'm going to be talking to Andrew Johnson of the website Check the Evidence. And we're going to be discussing 911 amongst some other topics out there. But before we get started on this here topic, I wanted to let everybody know that I'm very happy to be out of the hospital, back home and live on the air. I want to thank all of you for your support. I want to thank all the hosts that have filled in for me all these times I was in the hospital. I want to apologize to Nighthawk and some of the other people around here that I have not been able to always give a notice before I went into hospital. But when you get rushed in an ambulance and end up in a coma with a tube down your throat, notices are sometimes kind of hard to give. But I do try to do my best at any rate. Many of y'all may not be aware of the fact that I'm in the last stage of emphysema. I wanted to kind of get this out there real quick before me and Andrew started. And basically, this is the reason why I'm in and out of the hospital so much. I've got several lung conditions going on that's keeping me sick. I mean, I've got what they call bronchiect as is. It's not like bronchitis. And this thing just keeps you generating mucus, and it makes like a home for bacteria. I've got Mycobacterium avium, which causes pneumonia. And the emphysema itself knocks down the immune system, which is three ways to help you get sick. It's kind of hard not to go in the hospital. The good news is, last several sputum checks they did, the Mycobacterium avium was dormant, so at least it's no longer causing pneumonia. However, the defensive system's still down, and the home is still there for them. But we are also working on that. I want to thank Nighthawk for his recipe, you might want to call it, for the colloidal silver, the 6 drops every 3 days. I'm trying that, and I'm going to hope that it helps to keep me out. Somebody also recommended cleaning my mask for the nebulizer every treatment instead of every day or every other day, so I'm doing that now. And I've also recently been diagnosed with sleep apnea, and they're going to get me a CPAP. This machine is supposed to push fluid down into my out of my lungs and get rid of that home. So hopefully that will help. So if you folks are kindly bear with me, I'll hopefully quit having this here problem in the very near future, and keep me in your prayers that I won't be going back in the hospital anytime soon. Can you guys hold on for just one moment? I've got a distraction on my end I need to take care of real quick. Okay. Anyway, like I was saying before, I got a distraction. I'm just going to be honest with everybody. Somebody just happened to knock on the door at the beginning of my show. And I had to tell my wife to go answer it, so I do apologize for that. I also want to let everybody know that while I've been in the hospital, my wife has tried to take over the bills for me, and being inexperienced, she has made some errors. There have been some checks bounced, and we're trying to catch that up. And as a result, we've canceled our business internet. We still got residential for now. A problem is, I may not be able to hold on to it. If I end up going offline, I won't be able to, you know, continue the show until I can get back online. I'm hoping and praying that don't happen. I'm trying to prevent it from happening. I want to let everybody know, if anybody wants to support Talk Now Radio, my PayPal is Royce41200@yahoo.com. And my mailing address is 2218 Gostick, G-O-S-T-I-C-K, Houston, Texas, 77008. Any little thing that y'all send in could help me keep the residential internet going until I could get some of these checks paid off and get back up on my feet. So I just thought I'd throw it out there. I don't know if you can or not, but we'll play it by ear. So, Andrew, one more thing, folks. Do not forget to support Revolution Radio. Nighthawk has a lot of hosts on this show. It covers a lot of topics. It's getting the word out, and he's doing a lot of good, and he needs the support. So now, Andrew, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Royce. Thank you very much for inviting me on to the program, and I'm glad that you've been able to come back and do it, because we spoke a few weeks ago, didn't we? And then you went into hospital again. So I'm glad that you're out and you're able to do the program. I think it's great that you've persevered so much.
Well, I got to tell you, you're one of the people I didn't think that I would a debt of thank you to, because you were understanding with me when I didn't show up for the show last time we had it scheduled.
Yeah, that's not a problem. I mean, obviously, in those sorts of circumstances, you know, that's not, it's, you know, you have to, you got nothing else you can do anyway. So, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah, once you're there and you're unconscious, you're not going nowhere till you wake up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
at least nowhere fast.
Yeah, it's a real thing to have to go through, and you know, I've not been through that myself, but you know, I've seen family in that situation once or twice, so you know, I've seen it from that perspective.
Yeah, well, I can imagine everybody's got family that's been in and out of the hospital for cancer, stroke, COPD, or one thing or another. It's, I think, part of the aging process also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we were talking in Skype earlier before the show about some of your favorite topics you'd like to talk about. And maybe before we start, you'd like to tell everybody a little bit about your website, which I know for a fact. I've been visiting that website for probably, I'd say, close to 10 years. So I know you've been there for a while.
Mm. Sure, yeah. I mean, I started getting into what I call alternative knowledge. It was about 12 years ago now, actually, and I initially looked into Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project when I'd had a sort of reawakened interest in the UFO phenomenon, and that was, you know, I had a sighting when I was about 10 years old, and I've always been interested. And then I saw a program about the Rendlesham Forest incident, which happened in 1980, and I went onto my internet, you know, that time, and in 2003 this was, we'd just got a good always on internet service then, and I started looking for information about this Rendlesham incident, and I found the Disclosure Project, and I downloaded the videos and watched the videos from that, and I thought, wow, you know, this is, I'd never heard about this, because it, the Disclosure Project, you know, was came to the fore in 2001 with the press conference that Stephen Greer had organised, and I think, I mean, I later had a short communication with him, and I think to organise that press conference, I think, cost him about $40,000, you know, so that's an awful lot of money to be putting out there when you know you're not really necessarily going to get anything back from that. And so I watched all of that, and I realised, having watched it, and the caliber of the witnesses that were involved, that there was a UFO cover-up. You know, there was a huge cover-up in relation to that issue, and this was patently evident from what Stephen Greer had shown, and the way that I'd not heard about hardly any of it, you know, and it wasn't covered here on the mainstream media or press. So I knew, I was convinced at that point that there was a UFO cover-up, and I felt that I had to sort of start speaking out more about that at that time, because it was extremely important information that people didn't know about. And that really was the start of the journey, which led me down various other avenues and alleyways to where I've got to, you know, with what's on the website. And I set the website up, I think it was originally set up in 2006, and then I revamped it in about 2007 or 8 with a content management system. And you know, it's been an archive, essentially, almost like an online filing cabinet, if you will. And I've written quite a lot of the articles myself, but not all of them. I've had other people that have contributed material on various topics. And it's all free, you know, there's no, like, you don't have to register or pay anything to download anything or anything like that. So you can just go on there. So I do encourage people to look at it. I encourage people to write to me if they are confused by anything or can't find anything or think that something is hopelessly wrong. You know, I invite people to correct anything that they find that's wrong. And I'm glad when people show me that they've read it, you know, they've actually looked into it.
If they're showing you it's wrong, then they had to read it to know it was wrong.
Exactly. And that's what I would like. You know, just a little bit about my background. You know, I regard myself as sort of a pretty much an ordinary person, really. I don't, you know, I went to university. I did a degree in computer science and physics, finished that in 1986. And I've essentially worked in software engineering, which is an engineering discipline, which essentially is to do with problem solving and designing solutions to the problems which you're tasked with solving in a software context, which is computer programming. And quite often when you do that sort of work, you know, you have to sift through quite a lot of information fairly quickly to get to the nitty-gritty, you know, to get to the important facts that you need to solve the problem. And that's kind of the approach that I've sort of had, because that's the approach that, you know, I've developed in my work to all the topics that I've looked at and tried to filter out some of the noise and so forth, and crystallize that into some of the articles that I've written and videos that are on there that some of the people have kindly filmed for me in various ways and various places. You know, and I've given a few talks mainly around the UK, but I've been to Italy once or twice, and over to the Netherlands. So, you know, I've been looking at a lot of these fields for at least 10 years now, and I found that there are some interesting connections between them. You know, as I mentioned in our quick little chat on Skype,
right? Energy, for one thing, is
right. Exactly. So when you start to look at this concept of free energy, you know, and, you know, you start finding out about these generators, you know, magnetic motors that run without batteries or without electricity. And, you know, and then you find the Stan Meyer technology, you know, and all this sort of thing. And I found, well, in 2006, actually, that this is connected to 9/11 quite directly, more directly than most people will realize.
You're the first person to make that connection that I'm aware of.
That's interesting that you say that, because not a lot of people are familiar with this, which is why I suggested it as a topic.
Well, you know, I'm like you. I've researched these subjects for well over 10 years myself, mm-hmm. and I've seen a lot of theories about 911. But to my knowledge, as many different conspiracy theories as I've read about 911, mm-hmm. I have yet to read a connection to UFOs.
Well, it's not so much the UFO issue directly, but I can lay that out for you. It's kind of tangential to the UFO issue, because it actually relates to what a couple of the witnesses in Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project said. Wow. You know, because if we start off there, and I'll give a quick summary of that for anyone that's not heard of it. The Disclosure Project, to my understanding, that is the sort of it was in embryonic form in the early 90s, and I think Bill Hamilton was involved with sort of getting quite a lot of the original witnesses together in a set of files, so to speak. And I think he passed a lot of that information to Stephen Greer in the early 90s. And there's a very good article on Grant Cameron's website, presidentialufo.com, where you can read about how that sort of seed grew. And then, you know, Lawrence Rockefeller got involved, and he funded, I think, some of Greer's activities, which a lot of people, of course, have criticized, you know, because the Rockefellers have got obviously a fairly bad name, you know, because of their oil interests and global financial interests. So they're regarded as kind of, you know, some of the bad guys, so to speak. And I know that Greer is sort of taking some heat for that. But anyway, you know, set that aside for a moment, and he produced this press conference 2001. I think it was 21 witnesses took the stand at a press conference, and it was like a mock congressional hearing. And we had people like John Callahan, who was the head of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Accidents and Investigations Board, and he talked about the Japan Airlines case in 1986, where they tracked a UFO for an hour. And that was all very well documented. He had the sort of reports from the incident, and they had radar traces which were recorded on tape, and he recorded it with his video camera on the radar display. And there was a secret meeting with two people from the CIA, which he was told not to talk about, so that he was one of the witnesses. We had Robert Salas, the Minuteman missile commander. He talked about the event where 18 of the missiles in this Echo flight that he was in charge of, they went into a no-go launch situation following the appearance of an orange orb over the topside, which was reported by the topside guard. That, I think, was in 1967 in Minot, North Dakota. He testified that that was true, and he had documents which backed up part of the story which had been classified.
And if you don't mind my interrupting you on that note for real quick, mm-hmm. I'd like to mention this here on Robert's behalf. He recently put a book out about UFOs. I don't have it right in front of me to give you all the title, but I can mention it in a future show that he covers this information that Andrew's covering right now. Anyway, sorry.
Great. That's great, Royce. I mean, you know, anything that you can add in like that, that's brilliant. So he, you know, listened to his story, and then, you know, there was Larry Warren, who was at the Rendlesham incident. He testified that they filmed the landing, or some people were filming it, and various events which were going off there, and beams being shone down from an object which flew over the base and shone down beams into where the nuclear ordnance was stored, and the launch codes had to be changed after this event by a special team from Germany, and that's all documented, I think, in Larry Warren's book as well. So you had 21 stories which came out in this two and a half hours of testimony. And another one I'll just mention briefly, Mark McCandless, who I've been watching a presentation of, which was given in June last year at the Secret Space Program in, I think it was San Martino. That's just on YouTube. Some very good videos that people can watch, which were posted, I think, a few months ago. So all the disclosure projects are very compelling information, much of it. Stephen Greer then, he... At the same time as the Disclosure Project, pretty much, he announced something called Seize Power, which was like a, he said it was like a play on words, and it was SEAS Power, Space Energy Access Systems Power. That was the name he gave to it. And this was like an initiative that he wanted to start and or had started by the time I came across it. He wanted to get it. Inventors who'd, you know, come up with a free energy generator of some kind, whether it be a solid state device or a magnetic device, or, you know, something like the Stan Meyer water fuel cell, anything like that. He wanted to get put them together with investors so that, you know, the investors could evaluate the research, choose whether they want to invest and develop a device. And, you know, he said he was trying to get this going. I thought it was a good idea. You know, I looked at some of the documents he'd put together. It seemed fairly, you know, seemed all right to me. Yeah, I mean, that was going back to 2001. It ran till 2003. But I'll come back to this story a bit later on. And I'm going to sort of divert a bit away because I'm sort of summarizing my journey. So, I found out about Disclosure Project. I found out about the energy issue and how Greer's argument to me made a lot of sense, in that he said that, well, if you accept that these craft are coming here, you know, from elsewhere, and they don't run on coal, they don't run on gas and gasoline, they don't run on nuclear fission power, it must be some other energy source that they're using.
I would have to be. Think about it. I mean, from my perspective personally, and I'm sorry for interrupting again, but even as you said that, the thought that occurred to me, it could not be a fuel that burns up and evaporates in any kind of way, shape, and form because of the vast distances of light years in between.
Right, right. I mean, you know, people have seen these things traveling at very high speed, disappearing in front of their eyes, you know, going under the water, you know, coming in and out of water, bodies of water. This is not a conventional fuel system that they're using, or propulsion system.
You know, and then renewable, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, you hear the phrases, you know, energy from the vacuum, zero point energy. And then, you know, you'll hear talk about the stories, for example, of David Adair, who claimed to be a young, gifted rocket designer. He was, you know, he tells this story about going to Area 51 and being shown this engine and asked to back engineer it. And, you know, there's the Bob Lazar story, whatever people think of that, you know, mixed sort of feelings on that. So you have all these types of stories, which, you know, when you study them, lead you to understand that, yes, there is another type of technology. And Stephen Greer, I think, was right. And he connected a big dot for me. You know, that I still, though I'm going to go on and say other things, I still thank him for that. He connected the UFO issue and the free energy issue. And I thought, well, of course, it's obvious. That's one of the reasons for the cover-up. It's not, they're not bothered about you knowing whether there's aliens or not, or whether the aliens have landed or whatever it is. They're bothered about the technology. That's the key thing that they don't really want you to know about, because the way that we are controlled as a population, in a word, is through scarcity. You know, scarcity of resources, or scarcity of money, or scarcity of time, or scarcity of energy. Those are the ways in which we're controlled. And so anything which can illuminate an area of research to say, oh, yeah, well, things don't have to be like that, actually, if you know about this, and you know about this, and you know about this, then things don't have to be like that. I think any area of research, be that to do with, you know, for example, you mentioned colloidal silver, which is very cheap to make. You can make your own for, I don't know, $10 a gallon, probably less or something, you know, if you make your own, which compared to antibiotics, for example, it's, you know, 100 times more expensive probably. And all that money goes to, you know, pharmaceutical companies. So that's why they don't want you to know so much about colloidal silver. That's why it's not, you can't just go to Walmart and get a bottle of colloidal silver, you know, instead of a bottle of whatever, you know, mouthwash, for example. So anyway, going back to the Stephen Greer thing and the energy connection, that was a big connection for me that he made, and that was made in my mind in around about 2003. I started to investigate around that time what might be called other conspiracies or other areas of research. And I'd already begun to look at, for example, cold fusion. In fact, I looked at that when I got my very first internet access in about 1997. I wanted to see what happened to the field of cold fusion research, because I'd heard nothing about that for about 10 years. Seven or eight years. And that was one of the first things I found information on. I found some good websites even in 1997. And I noticed that Stephen Greer had talked about that in passing as well, I think, in one of his talks. So I was beginning to make these connections then. And then I started to look into 9/11. And I came across this phrase, state-sponsored terrorism. I can't remember where exactly I came across it, and I thought, well, state-sponsored terrorism, what?
That's a nasty phrase.
Yeah, exactly. I've never heard of that. What does that mean? And I can't remember exactly what it was that I read, but it was basically about how groups, terrorist groups, were funded by the CIA to help make them successful in their activities. And this was done through covert means. So to the general public, whichever group it was, you know, Mujahideen or, you know, Tamil Tigers or whoever it might be, in whatever country they were trying to manipulate the politics in, that group would be funded to create acts of violence, murder, damage to property, you know, whatever it was, overthrow leaders by the CIA or by, you know, MI5 or MI6 from this country. And they would do this so that they would, you know, move the political agenda in the direction that they wanted it to go, or just destabilize the regime or the country or whatever it was. And then in relation to 9/11, I began to read things about the way that the World Trade Center was destroyed. And then I watched this video, and this video was called, had an intriguing title. It was called 9/11, The Great Illusion. And I thought, Great Illusion? Well, that seems a strange title, because I know that I know what I saw, you know. It's not like a UFO thing, you know, where you're not sure whether you've seen it or not sometimes.
Hard to miss a tower collapsing in on itself.
Well, quite so, you know. And I thought, so I watched this video, and it was by George Humphrey. And I understand he's from Texas. And the particular thing that caught my attention the most, I mean, you think you'll probably still find that on video online somewhere, but I think it's
actually,
a bit...
Actually, I got it right here. When you said it, I Googled it, and right up the very top is the Google YouTube.
There you go, yeah.
I mean, I'm pasting it in the chat room right now.
Sure. And I thought, well, it was well put together, you know, well structured, easy to follow. And the thing that stood out for me, because of my background in physics, was there was about 2 or 3 or 4 minutes on how the towers collapsed. And in fact, I found out later that they didn't collapse, and I'll try and get onto that. So I thought, wow, how did I miss this? And it showed this little calculation where if you use the equations of motion, which was developed by Galileo and Isaac Newton 300 years ago, you can see that these towers, the way that they were, I'll say collapsed, but they only appeared to collapse. They didn't actually collapse. They disappeared, actually, in about 10 seconds or less than 10 seconds, between 8 and 10 seconds. I think it was about 8.1 for the first one and 9.7 for the second or something, disappearance time. And how can that be? Because that means when this thing was coming down, the bits were coming down, little bits were coming down, they were coming down as if the building was not even there. And that's impossible.
No underpinning, no foundation.
Yeah, it's like the whole underpinning foundation just disappeared all at once. And, you know, I did this little calculation using an equation, S equals UT plus half AT squared. That's one of the equations of motion that you can use. So I knew that. I was familiar with that from my studies in physics in years past. And it came out 9.16 seconds. I'm like, wow, why have I never heard this before? Why has no one said this before?
I got to tell you, I sat there and watched that thing collapse in on itself on TV. Mm-hmm. And the first thing out of my mouth is, no way, that is structurally impossible, architecturally impossible. Mm. It just does not happen that way.
And I remember thinking, you know, the thought that went through my mind, I mean, obviously I was pretty much aghast, as most people were, and that was part of the reason why the cover-up has been so successful. And I'll try and get onto that a bit later. But, you know, so I looked at this and I thought, why have I never seen that? And I remember that when I looked at the news broadcasts and I saw the close-up of the tower, you know, sort of turning to dust, actually, as it did, I thought, oh, there's been an earthquake. My first thought was that an earthquake had happened and it had shaken the building down, you know. And I thought, and then I thought, no, that's not right, because New York's not an earthquake zone. Yeah, exactly. There's no fault lines there. I mean, they get tremors every now and again, just like we do here. But I thought, you know, and then I just dismissed it. I just assumed, you know, that what I was told on the TV was the truth. And if anybody, anything obvious like that, I would have been told that. I didn't believe it. You know, and then I found out about the surviving hijackers that was, you know, listed on the BBC website. And I found out about, you know, the debris at the Pentagon, being no real plane parts there. And the hole at the Pentagon didn't really seem to match that would have been made by a plane. And on and on and on. And I became... You know, the Disclosure Project thing had kind of faded out for me to some extent, at least. And 9/11 actually became more important to me as an area of research. And what I did was, this little equation that I spoke about, I started posting that on a couple of physics forums because I wanted to check that I hadn't, you know, there was something I hadn't missed. I'd missed something really obvious. And this, I started it on Fizzle, this page, and it ran for about 18 months. It got about 5,000 responses, this thread. It was incredible. And nobody could really explain why this sort of could possibly have collapsed in the way that it appeared. In fact, it didn't collapse. And so, you know, what happened next essentially was, which was where we start beginning to get onto the energy connection, is I was invited to join this website, and it was called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And I was invited by two people called Stephen E. Jones and Jim Fetzer. And they said they were forming this group of if I can coin a sort of phrase, skeptical scholars, who were sceptical of the official story of 9/11, which is basically the official story is, you know, planes crashed into the towers, hijacked, jet fuel came out of the planes, started fires in the buildings, the fires got bad, the fires weakened the structural integrity of the steel, and the building collapsed. That's basically the official story, and they claim that it underwent this pancake collapse, you know, and that was that, basically. But when you look into this story, you know, there are some basic problems. Like, if it was a pancake collapse, then why didn't we have a stack of pancakes, you know, where the buildings were? And indeed, we didn't. We didn't actually have hardly any material. And then so people were saying, oh, well, that was because all the steel was shipped to China. And of course, that story turns out not to be true.
That's why I laughed, because that's the first time I heard that one.
Yeah. That was put out in the early days. That story came out probably in 2002 or 2003, that it was a crime scene, and, you know, the people wanted to cover up the crime, so they shipped all the steel to China.
Oh, God.
But I believe that story. I believe that was why we didn't see any debris. But it wasn't until 2006, I think, that I was shown a few pictures, one of which was a picture of the field of where the towers were, and there was basically nothing there. I mean, I've got this picture on my website, and I've used it in presentations. But in the background of this picture, you can clearly see World Trade Center Building Number 7. Now, World Trade Center Building Number 7, people talk about a lot in 9/11 research, because that building was destroyed at 5:20 in the evening, approximately 5:20. It was a 47-story steel frame building. And it went down to the ground, basically sort of disappeared at 5:20 in the evening. Nothing hit it. It created a 0.6 seismic signature, which is the equivalent of hitting a jackhammer on the ground.
Yeah, that's not much.
That's right. Same with Towers 1 and 2. They created, I think, a 2.3 and a 2.6 seismic signature. It was as if only the bottom 20 stories of the building had gone to the ground.
Or that everything that hit the ground was dust, thus reducing its waste.
Correct. So it was as if the top 90 stories had literally disappeared before they hit the ground, according to the seismic signature. And we'll get on to that later. So anyway, so I was invited to join the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group by Stephen E. Jones and Jim Fetzer. Dr. Stephen E. Jones and Dr. Jim Fetzer, both professors. Jim Fetzer was at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, I think, if I've got that right. And Stephen E. Jones was at Brigham Young, and he was a physics professor. And so they were forming this skeptical scholars group, which I was invited to join, and they were doing things like writing press releases about why the official story was not 9/11 was wrong. And, you know, they were saying five scientists and professors disagree with the official story, put that out in a press release, you know, and try and wake people up that this official story was false. And Stephen E. Jones, he produced this paper, which he called Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Towers Collapse? That was the original title he gave to this paper. And he wrote in this paper that he believed from dust samples that he'd acquired through a lady called Janet McKinley, that thermite was used, planted within the buildings, and this was ignited using some undisclosed or unspecified mechanism, and the thermite melted through the steel girders, and that's what caused the destruction of the towers, essentially. He also said there were possibly other explosives in this mix of things, but he didn't really specify what those were. And I read this paper, and I assumed that, you know, this guy's a physics professor. I'm not. I've done physics, but I assumed he was honest and, you know, legitimate in what he was saying. And I think he went on Tucker Carlson's show on mainstream, and he asked to talk about Building 7, and they wouldn't show the video, which seemed quite suspicious to me that they wouldn't.
Would to me, too.
And so anyway, that all sort of proceeded along, and I got to know, we got to know a few other people in the group in a virtual sense, you know, people like Kevin Ryan, who was a chemist that worked at Underwriters Laboratories, who were tasked with testing some of the World Trade Center steel as a way of trying to determine what happened to the towers. So he was in that. There was another guy called Carl Weiss, and then another guy, I think Frank Greening, and a couple of other people. Frank Legge was also another member of this scholars group. Jeff Strahl. And I came into contact with a couple of other people like Russ Gerst, who became a very key contact later on. And sort of tangentially, actually, I came into contact with two other people who became of great importance later. Dr. Morgan Reynolds, formerly of Texas A&M University, and Dr. Judy Wood, formerly of Clemson University in South Carolina.
Now, you helped set me up with Judy Wood for an interview.
Essentially what happened was...
Hello?
I could probably do that.
I'm saying you already did.
I think she would...
I did it again.
Yeah, well, we could. Yeah, I may have mentioned it to her, but I'm not sure. I may have mentioned it to her, but I'd have to check. But yeah, she would be able to talk about. She, you know, her main area of discussion is what happened to the World Trade Center towers. She has basically determined that to the point where, you know, there's no, you can't really argue with it. She also took it to court. Which we'll get onto perhaps later, but yeah. So Dr. Judy Wood became a very key person in this story that I'm sort of relating to you, because what happened was I noticed in late 2006 that I was hearing a lot more about Dr. Judy Wood, but almost none of it was positive. You know, she was being attacked left, right, and centre. And I came across at some point this thing that she'd called the BBE, the billiard ball example, that she'd put together. And it was kind of like a thought experiment where she took this idea of considering the model of the World Trade Center and how the floors disappeared. And she took this idea of having a set of billiard balls, you know, arranged with triggers, so that you had one billiard ball at the level of each floor of the World Trade Center, and you worked out the free fall time for the billiard ball to go from one floor to the next, and then when it got to the next floor down, it would trigger the next one, and so forth. And so she did a graph, she drew it all out with the equations of motion, and she worked out that the I can't remember the exact time that it would have taken for the billiard ball to get to the bottom, but if you had a 1 second delay to allow this floor to disappear, It would take, you know, basically 100 seconds with a 1 second delay for each floor to disappear, you know, to get to the bottom. Which, of course, that's not what you saw. You know, the buildings didn't take 100 seconds or 110 seconds to disappear. They disappeared in 10 seconds. So that right there proves it can't have been a collapse. It wasn't a collapse in the normal sense, or a pancake collapse. Just by observation, you didn't really need to think about explosives or Al-Qaeda or conspiracies or anything. You just have to know how long the building took to disappear. And this was so simple, yet it hadn't been used as a way of, you know, pointing out to people that the official explanation must be wrong. It must be wrong. But her example was much more elegant, I think, than my freefall, you know, equation, which not necessarily everyone would understand. You know, they wouldn't necessarily be able to understand that. But balls falling down, you know, intervals, that's a bit easier for people to understand and visualize.
So you kind of like her way of putting it.
yeah, it was good. But I didn't hear about that until later. And then she was getting attacked on this forum by some of the other scholars. And I'm thinking, well, why is this going on? You know, and I didn't really pay a lot of attention to it because I'd already seen all these forum arguments, you know. But anyway, what happened was Stephen E. Jones had asked me, or he'd asked, not asked me personally, he'd asked if anyone could edit a video together for him of two clips of this apparent molten metal coming out of the side of the World Trade Center towers, one of the towers, just before it started this collapse process, as he was calling it. And he asked these two clips to be edited together so he could use it in a presentation. And I was, you know, I'm quite sort of au fait with video editing, and, you know, I'm not an expert, but I know how to convert video formats and all this sort of thing, you know. So I volunteered to do that for him, and I sent him back the clip, you know, by download link or whatever. And I understand he did use it in at least one of his presentations. And then I later saw this article by Dr. Morgan Reynolds and Dr. Judy Wood, where they were critiquing Steve Nee Jones's Thermite paper, and they were looking at his, how he described these buildings being destroyed and pulling it apart, basically, and showing what was wrong with it. And they mentioned my name in this paper, and I think, oh, why have they mentioned me? You know, what have I got to do with anything? And they mentioned about this video clip that I'd made for Jones, and they basically said that this video clip was misleading because it showed two events close together that were actually further apart, and Jones was using this clip to mislead people. And I looked at it, and I looked at what they'd written, and I realized that they were right. I realized that what they said was true, and the clip that I'd made was misleading, and it didn't really show what Jones was claiming to it showed. And it showed something interesting, but it wasn't really showing what he claimed it showed. So that's when I began to realize that Dr. Judy Wood was onto something. And she was basically talking about the towers and what happened to them, and that's all she was talking about. You know, she wasn't really talking about Al-Qaeda or, you know, bombs in the buildings. She was just looking at what happened to the buildings. And she was pointing out things, some of which I've already spoken of, that the buildings actually turned to dust, and that they did turn to dust. About 85 to 90% of the buildings turned to dust before they hit the ground. And if people go back and watch these videos, they will see that this is actually what happens, right? This is actually what happens. The buildings do turn to dust. You can see individual steel beams on their way to the ground. They start off in solid form, and then they turn to dust. And you can see solid steel girders in two or three cases at least turning to dust before your very eyes.
Instead of melting, turning to dust.
Yep, and they don't melt. So the turning to dust is not a process which involves heat. And we know that it doesn't involve heat because people that were on the ground, you know, running away from the cloud, the dust clouds go right over them, completely blacking out their vision. You know, we have videos of that actually happening.
Now, that involves vibration.
Well, possibly. We don't know precisely what the process is, but we have a good idea about some of the background to it, which, as I say, connects to aspects of what Stephen Greer was talking about. But we know the buildings turned to dust. We know that it wasn't a lot of heat involved. There may have been a little bit, but it wasn't, you know, we actually saw those initial fires go out. If you watch the towers coming down, you see the fires burning, then the sort of building starts transitioning and the fires go out. And that we have people in the dust cloud filming, you know, with a camera. The vision goes completely blacked out. Then the dust clears after a few seconds. Camera's still working. Person's still alive. Person is not burnt. This wasn't a hot cloud of dust. The witnesses, and there are 500 witness accounts on the New York Times website, I know, because I downloaded them all. Some of them described the dust cloud as being slightly cooler. And then you had these, Dr. Judy Wood is pointing out other things like these cars. There were 1,400 cars which had this weird toasting effect. Some of them were between a quarter and a half a mile away from the World Trade Center, yet they had a toasted metal. They had a sort of strange rusting effect. They had peculiar damage to them where some of the upholstery was unblemished, yet the outside was all burned. They had door handles missing, engine blocks missing, while the rest of the car was still intact. All kinds of strange things like this. We had people being levitated as they were. The dust cloud was coming down. We had strange fires, which didn't appear to be hot. We had the unburned paper, which was blowing through the streets of Manhattan while the building had disappeared. We had almost no sound of the building coming down, just like a loud rushing sound. There was no loud clangs or explosions, like bombs going off. There were explosions reported in the towers by witnesses coming down the stairs, If we get time, we'll talk about that later. So Dr. Wood was pointing out all these phenomena, you know, for she'd started doing that from day one almost, I think, but she'd definitely been doing it since 2004. That's when she started doing a few web pages to share with people. But it was in 2006 she started talking about directed energy weapons, because what she was seeing in the evidence was the evidence of some type of some energy effects. That's what she was talking about. And there was she was blamed for breaking up the scholars group, saying that because she was coming out with all this incredible stuff that no one would believe about energy weapons, which didn't even exist. But actually, that was all untrue. Because in 2003, for example, Donald Rumsfeld was asked a question at a press conference by a journalist about when they were going to start to use some of the directed energy weapons in the battlefield. And that was in 2003. And you hear about the creation of the MTHEL, the mobile tactical high energy laser from Northrop Grumman. That was developed in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. There's been some more stuff that's come out recently about directed energy weapons being used in the Navy. These are all hot directed energy weapons. So the people were basically lying. They were basically lying, saying that directed energy weapons didn't exist when they do, and you can easily show that they do. And I was very suspicious about this when people were obviously lying about what Dr. Judy Wood was saying.
Now, could it be any possibility these people weren't necessarily consciously lying but just didn't know any better?
Well, that was the problem, because when you'd point this out and you'd show them links to Northrop Grumman or whatever, they'd still repeat the same thing, you know. Oh, well, this is still nonsense, you know. They wouldn't retract what they're saying, like saying, oh, well, maybe she's on something here. Let's look at the evidence and see if she's right, you know, which is an honest response.
Right.
If you don't believe somebody and you're being honest about it, you say, let's look at what you've got, you know. Let's go through it. Let's follow it through. And she was a professor of mechanical engineering. She had a background in materials engineering science. And what she was pointing out was problems with what was happening to the materials, funnily enough. So when you've got a professor of mechanical engineering and materials engineering science pointing out problems in what you were seeing in the materials on the ground in the photographs, she'd looked at 40,000 pictures. Well, I, for one, am going to listen to that person, you know. So going back to the energy issue, so we started talking about energy weapons and Dr. Wood was, and people were going, that's all a load of rubbish. But no, you look at the evidence and it's not rubbish. It's actually true when you look at it. But one of the people that was starting to say rather unpleasant things was Stephen E. Jones. And he was claiming that she was attacking him, and she wasn't attacking him at all. She was trying to get him to be honest about the evidence rather than claiming, for example, that molten aluminium is silvery in appearance at all temperatures in daylight conditions. This is what Stephen E. Jones has said. And it's a lie. That is a lie. Liquid aluminium is not silvery in appearance at all temperatures under daylight conditions.
Thought it was yellow.
It is. If you heat it up enough, that's correct. It's a sort of yellowy orange cover. You've got to heat it up to like 1200, 1300 centigrade, I think. I forget the exact temperature. Molten aluminium becomes molten about 620 degrees or something. And indeed, at that temperature, yes, it is silvery in appearance. But that's not all temperatures. That's at 600. Heat it up to sort of 1200, 1300, 1400, and it starts to glow, just like, you know, other metals do if you heat them that hot. But that became an issue. In other words, Stephen E. Jones needed to have the molten metal in the building story. And you'll still read that today. If you go onto any 9/11 Truth website, just about, it will say, yes, and there was molten metal in the bases of all three buildings, 1, 2, and 7, for, you know, so many days or weeks or months. That is not true. That is not true. Or at least, it's not true that it was hot molten metal. There may have been molten metal, but we've now come to understand that if people did indeed see it, and we don't have any pictures of it, it wasn't hot. And there's been whole long raging arguments about that one section of evidence. But it becomes clear if you study the evidence around that, why they needed that story out there and why people still, to this day, repeat that story as if it was true. And it's not true, at least not in the way that is claimed by people like Jones.
It sounds to me like Jones might possibly be a troll.
Well, I don't want to use that word, but he does know what he's talking about. He definitely knows what he's talking about. But the real light bulb for me was illuminated by some kind person. I think it might have been Rosalie Grable or possibly Nico Haupt who sent these links. Was they sent me a video from year 2000, which was called Heavy Watergate. Heavy Watergate was the name of that video. And in that video, there's a short segment about Stephen E. Jones. Stephen E. Jones was involved in a field of research known as cold fusion. He was involved in that field of research in the 1980s and early 90s. And I found out later, indeed he himself admitted this, that Stephen E. Jones and his friend Paul Palmer actually coined the term cold fusion. They came up with that name, right? And a lot of the other researchers like Pons and Fleischmann, they didn't like it. Now, I need to explain what cold fusion is, because whenever I get to this point, people often don't know what it is. In 1989, two chemists, world-class chemists, called Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann, they made an announcement by press conference, which was very unusual, that they discovered this process. They didn't know what it was, but they could basically put a palladium electrode, and I forget what the other cathode and the anode was, but they would put this into a solution of lithium hydroxide, which was made with what's called heavy water, deuterium oxide, and with lithium hydroxide as well, mixed in together, into a cell, and under certain conditions, this would produce an anomalous reaction, which created anomalous heat. And with certain conditions, they could get more heat out of this beaker than they were putting into it from the electrical current that they were using. Didn't happen all the time, but that's what they were getting. They also appeared to be getting some neutrons coming out, as if this was a nuclear process. So this is when Stephen E. Jones came up with this term cold fusion, when it was more correctly entitled something like low energy nuclear reactions. And why this was so important and why it was so controversial at the time was it was possibly a way of getting nuclear fusion energy very cheaply without expensive nuclear fusion reactors and without any sort of nasty fission products plutonium or these other radioactive cesium.
Right, I was about to say, without the radioactive poisoning.
Exactly. So it would have been a huge discovery. And even now you go onto the internet and read about cold fusion. Oh, it's a load of rubbish. Those guys were just cranks. They were frauds, you know, or they just didn't know what they were doing. And it was just, you know, it was just a mistake in science. And this actually was brought to my attention in quite recently. I work for an organization in this country called the Open University, part-time. And an example of unethical science was brought up on an Open University course quite recently, within the last few months. And the example they used was cold fusion research. And the problem with that example is that it's not true. Pons and Fleischmann were basically lambasted and attacked by the scientific community, but their research was sound. And other people in Japan, reproduced their research, particularly also the work of John Bockris, who was an electrochemist at Texas A&M University. He reproduced it, and he also produced a phenomenon called transmutation in his cells. This was where he was getting copper turning into zinc or something. I forget the exact. So he'd have copper in the cell, but then when he ran the experiment for a few hours or a few days, he'd get small deposits of copper in there, which weren't originally there. He got a new element which had been created in this cell, transmutation. And this was
sounds like the making of the X-Men.
Yeah, I mean that kind of thing. So he was also they tried to get rid of him from Texas A&M. They had an 11-month investigation into his research, which in the end he was exonerated of any, you know, malpractice or anything like that. So all of that was going on. But then when I found out that Stephen E. Jones was connected to the cold fusion area of research, I thought, hang on, that's an energy phenomenon. And energy is exactly what Dr. Judy Wood's talking about. So that was a start of really the connection between energy and 9/11. And that's all factual. That's not theory, right? It is a fact. I must stress this. Stephen E. Jones makes no secret of his work in the field of cold fusion. Cold fusion, whatever you want to call it, low energy nuclear reactions or chemically assisted nuclear reactions, it is an energy phenomenon. That is a fact. Stephen E. Jones appeared on the 9/11 research scene being skeptical of the official story in 2005, in about August, September 2005, when he went on the Tucker Carlson show. That is also a fact. None of this is a theory, right? He then did this research into thermite allegedly being used. That is also a fact. You can go and read his paper. He formed the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group. That's a fact. And he invited me onto it. That's a fact. I can prove that. So we have all those as facts, and they can't be refuted. We also have all these facts about the destruction of the World Trade Center, such as the buildings turning to dust, the fact that there's almost no material there, the fact that there was no seismic signature commensurate with the size of the building, the fact that if you go into the basements, which went seven or nine stories below ground level, a lot of that area was undamaged. There were figures, 6-foot-high figures from a Warner Brothers store of Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner. They were recovered from one of the stores after the towers had been destroyed. How can that possibly be when they had 110 stories falling down on top of them? We had people in Stairwell B. 14 firefighters had been in to rescue people. They were, I think, about 4, 5, 6 floors up from the bottom. They were trapped as the building was coming down. They looked up. They saw daylight. How can this be when they had 100 stories of building above them? They walked out unassisted. How is that possible when they had 100 stories of building over them? And there's a whole documentary about that, about them and what happened to them, called The Miracle of Stairwell B. It's on YouTube. It's made by Channel 4 in the UK. How can that be? These are all facts. They're not theories. So let's not confuse the two. All right?
Okay.
So where are we? Right, so we've got 9/11, we've got energy, we've got cold fusion, Stephen E. Jones is working that. We've got, to me, what Jones was doing was he was trying to take attention away from the evidence that Dr. Judy Woods was pointing out. And over the next few months, and I'm talking between 2006 and 2007, it became clearer to us why this was so. Because we'd come across, or Dr. Wood had primarily come across, various effects. I'd mentioned some of them. Spontaneous rusting of cars. You've got some pictures from the World Trade Center which show cars on the same day showing rust after the destruction of the towers. I could show you some of those pictures. How can that be if when these cars are blocks away from the World Trade Center? Well, think about this. I talked about something called transmutation, which was where this copper was turning into zinc in cold fusion experiments. What about steel turning into iron? Because steel is a form of iron. And what about iron then rusting, going to iron oxide? What about that?
That reminds me of the Philosopher's Stone. I mean, for ages now, all the old sages have been trying to convert gold into,
exactly,
lead into gold.
Alchemy.
Steel into iron is the same theory.
It's the same type of thing. And then we've got these levitation effects. We have cars that are upside down. We've got one car parked opposite the park next to the World Financial Center. It's upside down next to a car that's the right way up. So how can that happen? And we've got several of these cars that are turned upside down. We have David Hansher, the New York Daily News photographer. He's got this account that he tells in October 2001. I've got it in a presentation. He's levitated and carried a block by this cloud of gravel, as he called it. How can that happen? We have people being levitated as they're coming down the stairs in the World Trade Center. We have one of the firefighters, his hat lifts off his head as he's walking down the stairs. What's going on? We're getting all these weird effects. So we're seeing some very strange effects here, which are not that explicable. We also have the mystery of the Bankers Trust Building, which no one, I haven't seen anybody talk about the Bankers Trust Building. It was a 40-story building, and it was across the road from the World Trade Center on 9/11. and you can look at this. A Deutsche Bank, or the Bankers Trust building, it was the recipient of some damage with this chunk of wheat checks, as Dr. Wood calls it, like a steel girder, pre-welded steel girder section, which seemed to fly off one of the towers, crash into the world, into the Bankers Trust building, and cause some damage. That damage was subsequently repaired, and by 2004 or 2005, the Bankers Trust building had all the damage repaired, and they started to rebuild it. Then in 2006, they announced that the Bankers Trust building had a mold infection, and it had to be taken down piece by piece. And it appeared that this building was undergoing ongoing rusting problems. The girders was continuing to rust. Some process was happening in that building, which meant they had to take it down piece by piece at a cost of $70 million. And it was done by a company that never demolished another building ever. So what is going on with this stuff? So we've got levitation, we've got energy effects, we've got transmutation, we've got weird fires, we've got pictures of cars in flames next to paper that's not burning. And then Dr. Wood discovered all of these effects in somebody else's experiments. These effects were discovered in experiments by a Canadian researcher called John Hutchison, who I'm not surprised if you would have heard of him, because he has also done experiments related to Nikola Tesla in the past. Have you heard of John Hutchison before?
Isn't he the one that came up with the Hutchison effect?
He is exact same person.
Then yes, I've heard of him.
Well, there you go. So we started, Dr. Wood and myself started talking about John Hutchison in, I think it was November 2007. And he had a blog where he'd got pictures. Guess what? He was making stainless steel rust. He was levitating things in his lab by firing different energy beams. He was had an experiment with a boat on a tank of water, and he would make this boat almost levitate, and you could see this water sort of doing strange things when this strange wave pattern when he was firing his energy beams at it of microwave and radio frequency energy, and he used magnetic fields and he used a Tesla coil sometimes, and he was mixing these forms of energy together to get these effects, and he was getting these weird fires as well. So what have we got? We've got levitation, we've got weird fires, we've got transmutation. Sounds like a bit what's happening at the World Trade Center to me, which is all in the evidence that's all in Dr. Wood's book and on her website. The book's called Where Did the Towers Go? So basically, Dr. Wood and I had started talking about this, as I say, in mid to late 2007, and I helped her by setting up a website, you know, one that you paid for, because she was using like one of these free ones with adverts, and it was getting quite intrusive to some of the pages. So I said, look, you know, let's just set this up on a website and away we go, you know. So we put it all on the website, drjudywood.com. I think just about all of it is still there. It might have moved around a little bit, but all the important stuff is still there. It's not very well organized. It's all there if you want to find it, but it's like an online filing cabinet, and there's a lot of stuff on there. So we were still sort of participating with this Jim Fetzer guy in the scholars group. Jones was continuing to sort of attack Dr. Judy Wood in certain ways and say that, you know, she was wrong, and, you know, it was definitely molten metal and thermite that was involved. And we knew that wasn't true by then. We knew for various reasons that wasn't true. And what had also happened in 2007, I don't know if we're coming up on a break now, are we?
Actually, to be honest with you, I was noticing that we were supposed to have had a break 10 minutes ago, and it never happened.
Oh, okay.
Now I'm worried that the break time's not going to come on for the next host.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens then. Okay. So Jones was claiming various things about molten metal, which we weren't true. And I'll point out another reason why in a moment. But what Dr. Wood had been doing was she'd been contacted by an attorney based in Connecticut called Jerry Leaphart, and he had realized that there was a way that a legal challenge could be made to a government body, essentially, because what happened was, we mentioned before a little bit earlier about the official report into the destruction of the World Trade Center, which came out in 2005. It was called The Collapse of the World Trade Center Towers, and it was published by NIST. That's the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and NIST.gov. And they produced 10,000 pages of reports which were meant to explain what happened to the towers. And they employed 23 private contractors to write those reports. And they paid them, I think, $16 million in total to all those contractors to produce these 10,000 pages of reports, which you can download. I know you can download them because I downloaded them all. And that came out, I think, in August 2005. So Jerry Leapart realized that there was an opportunity to use what's called the Data Quality Act. And she and he contacted Dr. Wood about this and said, look, you know, if you wanted to, we could challenge NIST under the Data Quality Act. And the way that you do it is you submit a request for correction. And you point out with the evidence that you've accumulated why their report is wrong. And you say, I want you to correct your report because it is wrong in these areas. And they are obliged then to review that request for correction. And if they agree to it, they correct their report and reissue it. And if they don't agree to it, you can sue them. And that's essentially what Dr. Wood did in 2007. She submitted this request for correction. That was in April 2007. She put in all the evidence she'd accumulated, or well, not all of it, but a fair proportion of it, 50 pages it ran to, about the energy effects, the lack of building, the dust, the seismic signatures and so forth. And I've got that document. It's on my website. You can download it. I can give a copy to anyone who wants one. That was all put into NIST in April 2007. And they refused to correct the report. And so with the help of Jerry Leapart, she sued the contractors for fraud. They put that into court, into the Southern District of New York in mid-2007. It was unsealed in September 2007. You couldn't talk about it until it was unsealed. And so that all went into the court document. So in other words, Dr. Wood was convinced. She knew she was right about what she said, and she was willing to take it to court, and she did take it to court. Dr. Steve Neer Jones and a few of the other of his associates, they also submitted a request for correction. And they'd been talking publicly for over a year about thermite and molten metal and various things related to that. They also submitted a request for correction to NIST. And in that request for correction, this official document, which could have formed the basis for a science fraud case, guess what they left out? Any mention of thermite or molten metal. There was no mention of that in their document. They did include a link to Steve Neer Jones's paper about thermite, but they didn't describe it. They didn't even put a summary in of what that paper was about, why it was saying that thermite was used. Wasn't in their request for correction. They didn't mention molten metal, which they talked about. Why would that be? Why would they not put that in their request for correction if they knew that that was the correct explanation? That is why I would say, and they've never come back to me on this, that is why I know that they're lying. Because if they had been truthful and they really did believe in their heart of hearts that what they were saying was true, they would have been prepared to take that to court, as Dr. Wood was, and she did later on in an appeal case, and that would have gone into the court record, but it didn't. So this story about thermite, which was, you know, let's remember, was put together by somebody who was working in the field of energy research. Steve Neer Jones also says that he's done work for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where they develop the atomic bomb and where quite a number of the black programs go on, the black budget projects. There, some of that goes through Los Alamos quite a bit, I think, as I understand it. So we've got this connection to Jones and Los Alamos, cold fusion, energy, and what happened on 9/11. And then we go to John Hutchison, who I've mentioned. We got in touch with John, and he talked to us. We did this interview with John in 2008, which is 7 years ago, where we went through some of these phenomena, and he sort of verified to us that, yeah, you know, those were the phenomena that he'd seen as well. And guess what? John submitted an affidavit in Dr. Wood's case to say that, yes, he'd, you know, created these effects, yes, they were described accurately and so forth. And his affidavit went into the court case. And that's all on the record now. So anybody that wants to go and read his affidavit can read it. And one other point I'd like to mention about that affidavit is that he talks about what happened in 1983 when he was visited by Colonel John Alexander. That might be another name you know of. Colonel John Alexander.
Don't ring a bell offhand.
Well, John Alexander has been many times on coast to coast. He is sort of like a UFO debunker. He doesn't quite debunk them, but he sort of, you know, he sort of pretends that he's interested in the topic and he doesn't totally poo-poo it. But,
raise
you know,
the area for doubt.
Yeah, and you can hear him doing that, and he gets on coast to coast quite regularly. He's head of the non-lethal weapons program, or he was when he was, I think he's retired now. But when he went to see John Hutchison in 1983 and worked with John for 4 months on some of the effects that John was creating, he was actually working on behalf of, guess where, Los Alamos National Laboratories. And, you know, John Alexander makes no secret of that. We've got documents which show that. So, again, that's all factual. That's not theory. That is not theory. None of that is theory. So that right there is another connection to Los Alamos, connection to that. I mean, you know, I think some of the energy research goes on at Los Alamos as well. So this to me, and from what John told us as well, John Alexander, when he went to see John Hutchison, he was familiar with the effects that John was creating already. He already knew about them, which means that he must have seen them elsewhere, not with John. So these effects were known about. So, and then the other thing that I want to go back to, you know, I said that I was going to connect this to Stephen Greer, and the connection is sort of in some ways tenuous, in some ways not.
Okay.
Is that if you read Stephen Greer's disclosure book, there's a couple of witnesses, I can't remember who William Porlek is certainly one, although he wasn't in Greer's book. William Porlek was one of the disclosure witnesses that didn't want his testimony published until after he died. And his testimony, William Porlek's testimony, P-A-W-L-E-C, was only published by Greer in 2007, which was when Porlek died. One of the companies that Porlek mentions, and at least two other witnesses in the Disclosure Project mention, I can't remember their names, is Science Applications International Corporation. And guess what? They were one of the contractors that Dr. Judy Wood sued because they helped to write the World Trade Center NIST reports. And indeed, Science Applications International Corporation were in charge of Ground Zero security from September the 12th, 2001, when the site was being, you know, sorted out, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look on Science Applications, and the fact they've changed their name now, I think they've recently, somebody told me they changed their name, and I can't remember what the new name is, so, but are you sure you'd be able to find them under that name? Guess what one of their areas of research is into? Directed energy weapons. That's one of their areas of research. It's on their website. Another of the contractors that was sued by Dr. Judy Wood is a company called Applied Research Associates, and they have a contract with the U.S. government to know anything about any directed energy weapon system anywhere on the planet, right? And they do research into directed energy weapons, and they do research into the manufacture and components, manufacture of components for directed energy weapons. That's on their website too. Those were both contractors that helped in the production of the NIST reports. So you can see, again, that's all fact. Is it just a coincidence, do you think, that we've got some of these groups involved with writing the, you know, the NIST World Trade Center reports? Jones comes on the scene just around the time that the NIST World Trade Center reports have come out. You know, I say to people that what I think was going on there is that when these 10,000 pages of reports came out, there's a lot of information in there. You know, obviously it's written up in the government, sort of to the government script or whatever, to hide some things. But there is still plenty of information there that can be latched onto by people like Dr. Judy Wood, Dr. Morgan Reynolds. So they need somebody, for example, let's take, say, Stephen E. Jones, a fairly well-informed physics professor, to start selecting things from the NIST report to talk about, which are going to be, you know, lead people down a dead end, basically. And that's what Jones was doing.
A troll would do.
Which is what a troll would do, if you know, exactly. You know, and I've got other evidence. I mean, I could talk probably for at least another hour just about Jones and what's, you know, I think he's been up to.
Well, if he's doing this on purpose, next question you got to ask is, what's his agenda?
Well, exactly. And so I think his agenda is to keep the discussion of energy research in relation to 9/11 covered up. And again, going back to Stephen Greer, unfortunately, he will not talk about 9/11. Now, if I was Stephen Greer and my disclosure witnesses had talked about Science Applications International Corporation, and somebody wrote to me and said, did you know that Dr. Judy would have sued that company for their... I'd be right in there like a shot saying, what, 9/11? Wow, let's see what the connection is. Does this mean that they've used some of that technology, you know, from Area 51 or wherever it is, and turned it into a weapon system? You know, I'd like to know about that. I should be thinking about that and talking about it. Greer will not talk about that. He'll never talk about that. He won't talk about 9/11. Last time I heard him talk about it, he thinks Al-Qaeda did it. I mean, for a man of Greer's intelligence and research, that's just ridiculous. You know,
it could be that he has thoughts he just don't want to share them.
Well, that's different, though. He could just say, don't want to talk about it. Sorry, I know what you're on about, but I really don't want to discuss it. I want to stay focused on, you know, the energy issue or whatever, or the UFO issue. He's never said anything to like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, if anybody listening knows that he said something, but to my knowledge, he hasn't. So we'll explore that a little bit more because I realized that Greer, I realized early on he wasn't talking about 9/11, which I thought was a bit odd, because somebody like him should be interested in the truth of what happened on 9/11. Anybody should, because it affected, I mean, it happened, you know, 3 or 4 months after his press conference, for example. So even that, to me, would be a factor in why, you know, he should be interested in this. So why wasn't he talking about it? Got to do something here for a second.
Right. Okay.
Then we have to sort of go forward to 2007 again, from 2003, say, with the seized power thing that I talked about. Because in 2007, Stephen Greer came up with a new website, and it was called Aero 2012. And on this website, he was showing how he would be looking into research of free energy devices, and he was going to connect inventors and investors and, you know, funnel money into free energy projects. And I thought, hang on a minute, I've heard this somewhere before. And so I went on to the Seize Power website and I looked at it, and these sites are both now defunct. You can get them out of the Internet Archive, webarchive.org. And I looked at these two websites and I found that they were identical, except all they'd done was they changed the logo from Seize Power to Aero 2012, and they changed the colour scheme of the website. Other than that, it was the same layout, same button titles. You clicked on the buttons and you got the same articles. No new articles, no nothing. There was nothing to say, you know, why this hadn't worked, why the original Seize Power had failed, what had gone wrong with it, da-di-da. None of that. It was all exactly the same website. So that's when I became extremely suspicious that what had happened to all this money that he'd raised, what had happened to all the inventions. And again, the Aero 2012 thing went on for 2 or 3 years, and I think it was in 2009 or 2010, I heard Greer again. I heard him on Coast to Coast or another broadcast. Oh, yeah, I'm starting this new initiative. It's called the Orion Project, and we want to build a laboratory. We want to build a laboratory. We need $3 million to build our own laboratory so that we can fund all the right scientists and researchers. And I thought, hang on a minute, you've already asked for this Aero 2012 stuff and, you know, Seize Power. What's going on? And I also looked at the Orion Project's board of directors, which, if you look at the page in the Internet Archive, you can see that the board of directors, there were quite a few changes in it, and I found one or two familiar names. I won't go into details on that site as well. And then it changed again, because I think it was in, a couple of years ago now, 2013, Stephen Greer came back, sort of, he was kind of rejuvenated with a Sirius Disclosure project, the Sirius film about this Atacama alien, or alleged alien, which actually wasn't in the end, it was a human. So then following that Sirius film, which was made by somebody else, it wasn't made by Greer. I mean, there was actually, if you watch that film, for those that had researched Disclosure Project and so on, there was very, very little new information in that film. Most of it was repackaged 10-year-old testimony. They had the Atacama alien story, which basically didn't amount to anything. And Dr. Gary Nolan concluded that it was almost certainly a human fetus of some kind. You know, Greer tried to sort of say it might have been alien, but I think at the end of that, it wasn't an alien. It was almost certainly human.
I would have doubted it was even human from what I saw of the picture.
Well, it certainly didn't look human, but I think from the DNA, it was something that was very close to human, you know, unusual though it was. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but just to finish that point about the Orion project and so on, he then came out with the Sirius Disclosure Technologies Initiative, which again is very similar to Orion project and the Seas Power and the Aero 2012. You know, I've written all this up on my website, and all the links and stuff are there if people want to go and follow this up and check, you know, whether I'm not just sort of talking out the top of my hat, you know. But I mean, again, I've totally lost any faith in Greer now. I mean, I recently saw a video with him. I think it was filmed early this year in January, February or March. And he's giving this talk. I believe it's in Washington, D.C. And he's giving this kind of workshop or whatever. And he says in this workshop, I could give people a link, but 1 minute into this workshop video, it's about 18 minutes long, he says, and what I have learned is disclosure and complete openness about all these technologies. You cannot fix this problem from the consciousness that created it. So he's talking about we need complete disclosure, complete openness of the hidden technology. Absolutely we do. That's what I think we need. But then later on, just about 7 minutes later in this video, he says, and I'm quoting from this because I typed this out, as some of you may have heard, I can't go into any details about it. I was asked to go to an island in the last few months with about 120 world leaders, people from Goldman Sachs and McKinsey. So hang on a minute. He just said he favours disclosure and complete openness, yet 7 minutes later in the same video, 8 minutes later, he's saying, he can't go into details about a secret meeting he was with people from Goldman Sachs and McKinsey, some of these, you know, powerful global corporations. So what's going on? What's he actually telling us?
What's he really willing to disclose? Sounds like partial disclosure.
To disclose? Yeah. So to me, there's something not. I don't know exactly what's going on with Stephen Greer. I'd be lying if I said that I did. I have my own suspicions. But if you just listen to what he's saying these days, and look at what he's been doing with Sirius Disclosure, which is basically recycling stuff. There's no new information there. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the witnesses that I've already mentioned earlier on, I think they're cast iron. And I think what they're telling us is true. And it's very important. But Stephen Greer has somehow, you know, he's kind of ring-fenced that almost. And it hasn't really gone that far. Well, I suppose that's not essentially true because Robert Salas and Robert Jacobs, they did get onto Larry King Live in 2008, I think it was. So there was some coverage there. But Stephen Greer is definitely not being on the level. Stephen Greer, to me, should be one of the first people to be talking about 9/11. He won't talk about it. It's very relevant, particularly when you look at the energy technology. The biggest issue is that we can see from what I've been telling you, and we could go on a little bit further, that basically what's happened is John Hutchison's technology, the Hutchison effect, right, it's been weaponized, right? It's already been weaponized. Right. And it was used to destroy the World Trade Center. That's the bottom line. Something very similar to what John Hutchison has been doing since the late 70s has been turned into a weapon system. And that's what was used to destroy the World Trade Center. Right.
Of course, John Hutchison condoning it.
Correct. Correct. I mean, he knew nothing about that. He just discovered the same effects with his own research. Right. Now, for example, You can come to understand that this is the truth. It's not a theory, right? What I've told you there is the truth. We don't know who has the weapon. We don't know who pressed the button. We don't know exactly how it works. We do know some of the operational characteristics from what happened on the ground, right? We don't know the part numbers. We don't know the power levels. You know, we don't know exactly how the energy is manifested. But we do know that it's almost certainly related to cold fusion. Because of the, for example, there were anomalous levels of tritium. That's one thing I didn't mention. If you look at the samples from the water, which was taken from the bottom of World Trade Center Building Number 6, it had 50 times the level of tritium in them, right? Which is far higher than it should normally be. Tritium is something that only forms in nuclear reactions. And that is exactly what Pons and Fleischmann received a lot of criticism for, because they found tritium in their cells, and so did John Brockris. So whatever happened at the World Trade Center is related to what happens in cold fusion experiments, which is related to Stephen E. Jones, right? So all this is all known, it's all there for people, they just don't talk about it. What you do get instead is you get Architects for Engineers for 9/11 Truth, who have 2,500 members who've signed their petition that the official story is false and they need a new investigation into 9/11. That's what you will hear across the internet and on most of the radio shows that, you know, you'll hear people talking about 9/11. You will not hear about John Hutchison. You won't hear about cold fusion. You won't hear hardly anything of what I'm telling you, which is all true, and you can all check it all for yourself, you know, with the links that are already available. And in history.
The links are available at your website, www.checktheevidence.com.
Correct. Anybody that, as I say, that's listening, can't find anything, or wants me to go over something, I can talk about it in person with if they like, on Skype, you know, just as I'm with you, or I can point them to the various articles. But you are going to have to study it if you want to understand it. It doesn't, you know, if you want to know it for yourself, you have to study it. You can't just say, oh, yeah, it's not, I don't believe you. You know, that's not fair, because you haven't studied it. You must study it. And you'll only through study know whether it's true or not. That's the caveat to it.
I'd kind of like to point out right now, if you don't mind it, you know, for you people out there listening, I know you're listening. I'm reading your comments in chat. That, you know, first thing about Andrew here is he's not selling a book. He's not selling pages to his website. He's not making anything off of it, but there's no monetary axe to grind. He's got everything on his website waiting there for you. He's got all of his sources down there. His only real goal, as far as I can tell, is he's concerned about the truth of what happened, and he thinks the information needs to be spread about.
Well, thank you very much, Royce. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And my book, where I've written a lot of this up in terms of 9/11.
Oh, you do have a book.
Yes, I do.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, that's fine, because you're right. What you said about it is right, because I'm not selling it. I'm giving it away, right? So if you go onto my website, you'll see there's a banner. The book's called 9/11 Finding the Truth, and you can download it in Kindle format, EPUB format, you know, for your iPad. Somebody very, very kindly, a lady called Cindy Laverty, she read out the whole thing for me, and so we've got an audio book that's free for everyone to download. It's 300 megabytes, but, you know, you can download that for free. The only thing that isn't free is the paperback, but that's because that's not free to me. You know, I can't make paperbacks for nothing, so it's 384 pages. You can buy that. I think it's about 10 bucks if you get it off Lulu. I don't think it's available on Amazon, because they just don't carry it for whatever reason. That's just complicated to explain why they don't carry that. But you can get it from Lulu for the paperback version if you want the paperback version, for about $10.
Do you have it in PDF?
Yes, its PDF is on there as well. If you just put my name, Andrew Johnson, 9/11 Finding the Truth, it should bring up the page. And, you know, you can download the PDF and find it all on there. It's basically, it's not an ordinary book in terms of, it's really a compilation of articles which I wrote over a period of about 4 years. As, you know, the story that I've given you in this hour and a half, what have you, it fleshes out a lot of that story, and it will show you why, you know, I know what I know is true, you know, by and large. So people can go and download that and read it. You know, you may find it's a bit of a slog to get through it, but the information is there, and you can verify it. You can see the emails that I exchange with people. Some people who read
my – you'll be reading a while.
Yeah, you will. You'll be reading quite a long time. But that, if people want to read it, that's great. If they don't want to read it, well, that's entirely their choice. But, you know, all I ask is that you don't criticize me or say that I'm, you know, making stuff up just because you haven't read what I've written or
listened. Yeah, I was about to say, nobody can justifiably tell you that you're wrong or you made it up or you're lying without first checking your story, without first checking your sources. To do so is just total BS.
Exactly. And there's one other important thing I think I should mention in relation to 9/11, because, again, not many people know about it, and it is absolutely vital that they do know about it. And it's something you can verify just by going to look at the weather data. And that's one of the other things which was discovered later on by Dr. Wood. In fact, she came across this, I think it was February 2008, and she posted it in April 2008. And it was, what she was doing was, she was looking at the way that the dust, which, you know, the towers turned into, was, it actually floated into the upper atmosphere, which again shouldn't really have happened. I mean, that sort of thing doesn't happen from a controlled demolition. You don't get fine particle dust floating up into the upper atmosphere. That just doesn't happen with controlled demolition. But it did happen with the World Trade Center. And she was looking for satellite pictures of the plume. And on one of those satellite pictures, she discovered something she didn't expect to see. And it was a hurricane. And that hurricane was called Hurricane Erin. And Hurricane Erin was about, the eye of it was about 500 miles from New York City. And the outer bands of Hurricane Erin on 9/11 were reaching as far as Cape Cod, right? Nobody knows about this. Nobody knows about this hurricane that started in, was classified, given a name as a tropical storm on the 1st of September 2001, moved across the Atlantic in a sort of fairly usual path.
Well, and did this hurricane play a role in what happened?
Oh, yes, we think so. We think so.
Could you explain that better?
Well, I'll explain what it did first, and then I'll try and explain the role.
Okay.
So the hurricane that nobody knows about, or hardly anybody knows about, and certainly hardly anybody except myself and Dr. Wood and two or three other people speak about in relation to 9/11, go and look on the Hurricane Data Center, anywhere, you can find it in the archives. Started as a tropical storm on September the 1st, moved up across to Bermuda, and it hit Bermuda on the 7th of September 2001 and did a bit of damage there. You know, there was a CNN report about that. And then it moved off out to sea, and they said, no, don't worry about it, it's going off out to sea. Yep, went off out to sea all right. Traveled in a straight line for 4 days directly towards New York City. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, as the events of 9/11 were about to unfold, it was at its closest to New York City, and it was moving at its slowest rate. And then on the 12th of September, it made a right-hand turn and headed out towards Newfoundland. So why would it be that this, on the morning news reports, of which I have four of them on my YouTube channel edited together, two out of the four channels did not report this hurricane. Two of them, the other two, said that the hurricane was going away, don't worry about it. One of them gave it the name of Hurricane Erin, and the other didn't even name it. Yet this had been traveling to New York City in a straight line for 4 days. And I think
there are suspicious.
Yeah. There are a couple of other hurricanes which have done that. I think Hurricane Bill was one that we had a similar one. And then we had, I think, Hurricane Sandy, was it? I think in 2012, which did a bit of damage. So we know that when hurricanes get to New York City, going towards it, they're going to issue warnings because it can still do damage even if the storm doesn't reach New York because of the storm swells. And if you get a swell of the sea and it comes over the flood defenses, it'll flood Manhattan, which is what I think happened with Sandy a little bit. So why wasn't anybody warned? Why weren't they being warned? And this is well documented. This is well documented. We had a flight attendant who contacted us, Joey Moore, and he said that they weren't told about this hurricane, which was in the area during their flights. You know, they weren't told about it, and normally they would be in such circumstances. So there's something strange going on with this hurricane. Now, if you read Dr. Wood's website and listen to her lectures, which are online, all available free, I can even give people DVDs for free, which I've been doing for the last 7 or 8 years now. You will see that she shows information from the weather reports that thunder was reported at all three New York airports on 9/11, dry thunder. They heard the sound of thunder, which means that what is thunder caused by? Well, it's caused by the discharge of lightning. What's lightning discharge caused by? Build-up of an electrical field. An electrical field. So in other words, the field effect, bit of a clue there, the field effect from the hurricane was felt as far as New York City. Guess what John Hutchison uses in his experiments? Electric fields, electrostatic fields from Tesla coils. If you look at a hurricane in cross-section, what does it look like? It has a columnar centre, it has a the ground at the bottom, and it has a large cloud base at the top. This looks like a Tesla coil. This looks like a Tesla coil. Guess what else Dr. Wood found out? She found that the Earth's magnetic field, as measured by 6 different magnetometers in Alaska, was disrupted throughout the events of 9/11. That's in her book and on her website. Just Google 9/11 magnetometer Alaska, and it will bring up the page for that and show you all the graphs and the data that she generated from the University of Alaska's website. And we can see, actually, the magnetic field starts to change 20 minutes before the first quote-unquote plane crash. Why would the Earth's magnetic field start to change 20 minutes before the quote-unquote first plane crash and the first deflection of the Earth's magnetic field, which was measured, be at a minimum, at the precise moment this alleged first plane hit the World Trade Center? Well, that's into another discussion, because it wasn't a plane that hit the World Trade Center, or at least it wasn't a plane that did the damage, and it probably wasn't a plane at all that actually hit the towers. That's another very difficult pill for people to get to grips with and to swallow and to think about. And it's something that other researchers will not talk about.
I got something to add in at this here point that I think may fit right in with what you're just now talking about. Thunderbird in the chat room said, Studio A, which is my studio, for your guests to comment, back in the 1950s, Wilbert B. Smith, author of The New Science, was told that the P-51 from Stanford Field, just north of Hawk, /RR, disintegration was due to molecular disassociation from flying too close to a UFO in a region of reduced binding energy. Pilot and plane were a mess. Smith had a super constellation flying over North America. He's describing a situation with a UFO involved in the same type of energy situation that I hear you describing from back in the 1950s, if I understand this correctly.
Well, I'd like to congratulate Thunderbird, because I think he or she is the first person that I've ever heard mention that story, which I'm very familiar with, in relation to what happened, what I've been talking about, basically. And, you know, I'd like to, if it was possible to give him a gold star, I'd like to give him 10, because that I think is exactly Wilbert Smith. You know, I've done a whole 2-hour presentation on Wilbert Smith, largely thanks to what Grant Cameron uncovered, and that's on my website. But yes, this idea of binding forces, which Smith said he was told about by these, you know, these beings, the boys' top side, that he was told about, and he did experiments to measure these binding forces. I think that's exactly what we're talking about, and I think that John Hutchison found a way to change the binding forces within materials. And this whole concept of anti-gravity and free energy, this is where it joins together. If you manipulate gravity, you know, you get free energy. Or if you manipulate free energy, you get gravity effects. And this is precisely what John Hutchison is doing. And this is exactly why there is a huge cover-up involved. Not only in relation to 9/11 do we have, you know, the hijackers, Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda story, that's the official cover-up. We then have another cover-up, which is what my book's about, which is, you know, bombs, thermite, nuclear devices in the buildings, and various flavors of this which have been put out, most of which I've written about in one form or another in my book. That is the second cover story. That is the disinformation story to rope in most of the skeptical people who don't even look at UFO stuff, don't look at energy stuff, they don't look at, you know, these paranormal effects and things like Wilbert Smith and binding force. They don't look at any of that. Oh, bombs in the building. Yeah, it's obvious it was that. Somebody planted the bombs, blew up the building. End of. That's my story. No, the government's wrong. They're just fascists. But that energy weapon story, that's just clearly disinformation, because that's just like Star Trek science fiction and I'm not buying it. You know, that's the situation that most people are in with 9/11. But yeah, absolutely, the binding forces, That's absolutely what's involved. And I think what was proved on 9/11 was that somebody, you know, we don't have to wonder whether somebody has got anti-gravity technology. We don't have to wonder anymore whether somebody has got free energy technology. We know, because of what happened on 9/11, that technology is real. The technology, it must exist to do what was done, as Dr. Wood says. The towers, you know, are they there or are they gone? They're gone. How did they disappear? They turned to dust. How did they turn to dust? Well, something turned them to dust. They didn't just turn to dust by themselves. We know it wasn't, you know, we know it wasn't bombs. We know it wasn't thermite. We know it wasn't nukes. We know it wasn't a storm. We know it wasn't an earthquake. It was something else. What is this something else? It's technology. It's someone's technology that was used. End of debate. End of debate. No debate, no theories. It's somebody's technology that was used. It's a technology that we don't fully know of in the white world, but it is nonetheless real. And somebody knows how to engineer gravity. They know how to engineer free energy. And they engineered those things together in a weapon system that was used to destroy the World Trade Center. You know, I can't stress enough how important that is. And as a third important thing, if we look at that hurricane and you just go and look at it, just go and look at the evidence, look at the data, look at its correspondence with the events. Was it steered? Was it put there? Was it moved? Well, we've got two chances, haven't we? Either they knew where it was going to go.
Or they made it go there.
Right. They knew where it was going to go, so they tied in the events of 9/11 to that motion. Or they moved it and did 9/11 along with it.
Well, I can be honest with you, when you were talking about it, the first thing I thought was HAARP.
Well, that's, again, to me, is a cover story. I know that HAARP exists. I know that it's a defense project. But to me, it's too public, and there are too many people talking about it. It's like the go-to card. Yep, or HAARP, that's what did it. End of, you know. So let's get it shut down, and then the problem will be solved. No, I think it's far more complicated than that. You know, I think there's several different types of technology involved here. HAARP may have been used to monitor certain things. I've read something about, you know, some of these graphs that you see. Maybe HAARP may be being used to monitor this other technology in operation. But what we're talking about essentially is geoengineering. If somebody steered Hurricane Erin, right, and they really did move it, and if you look at that, I challenge anybody to look at the events of 9/11, look at the motion of the hurricane, and say that that was a coincidence. If you accept that it's not a coincidence, then global warming, that's all a scam. Climate change, that's just all a scam as well. You know, so it's all basically a scam. All this thing about peak oil, that's a scam. 9/11's a scam. The whole thing is a deception to keep people in a state of mental and physical, you know, slavery,
duress.
Essentially.
Yeah,
duress or slavery, or keep them under. So this is why I'm talking with such, you know, with such passion and such assertion, because, it, you know, I mean, but I've spoken to other people. I've spoken to Richard Dolan, for example, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yes.
I gave him, I put into his hand in 2009 when I met him at Leeds in the UK at a conference there. I hadn't written my book then. In fact, Richard Dolan is now a chapter in my book. I put in his hand the weather, you know, not the weather chart, but the path of Hurricane Erin on 9/11. I told him about John Hutchison. I told him about, you know, everything I've told you, essentially. And then a few months later, I hear him do a broadcast about 9/11. It was actually on the anniversary of 9/11 that he did this. What does he talk about? Does he mention Hurricane Erin? Does he mention John Hutchison? Does he mention energy effects? Doesn't mention any. Doesn't mention me. Doesn't mention Dr. Judy Wood. Doesn't mention the court case. Doesn't mention Hurricane Erin. What does he talk about? Thermite. That's what he talks about. Now, why would he do that? For heaven's sake, Richard Dolan, right? What does he talk about? He talks about black programs. He talks about breakaway civilization. That's a phrase which I think he coined, and I think it's a very appropriate one. Yet he doesn't talk, and he was one of the first people in the UFO community to talk about 9/11. He posted an article in 2005, I believe, about 9/11 and the problems with the official story. He was one of the few UFO researchers that stuck his neck out at that time and did that. but he will not talk about Hurricane Erin. He won't talk about Science Applications International Corporation. Why won't he talk about those things? They're all true. You know, you can reference them. You can find all of those things that I've said and find out they're true. But he won't talk about them. Jim Mars won't really talk about this very much. He's talked a little bit about it, but he says, oh, yeah, I think it's just a theory. You know, no, it's not a theory, Jim. It's not a theory at all. The evidence is there for you to establish that, you know, what is true.
Well, you know, there are some people, though, once they have their pet theory, you can give them all the information in the world. They just won't look at it. They don't need to. They already know.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And you see, I think, I suppose what I find exasperating is that within, you know, the UFO research community, we're not supposed to be like that. We're always supposed to be open, you know, to looking at the evidence. And if we're really on a quest for the truth, you can't just stop. You know, you've got to keep, if some new evidence comes to light,
you're no longer on the quest. I mean, think about it. This is
one of the problems, that if you find something that's...
You're convinced of, but you're no longer on the quest. You don't need to be. At least in your mind.
Right. Right. That is true enough. And so, you know, you reach this sort of a paradox, because you become convinced about something, but at the same time, you know, you have to be open to new evidence which might overturn that story. You know, but I've been talking about this now. And as I said, you know, in 2005 and 2006, I was convinced that the World Trade Center, going back to that, was destroyed by bombs planted. You know, I was convinced of that. But I was still open to looking at these other things which were put in front of me. And I realized that that story was untrue. And since that time, since about 2008, I've not seen anybody else put out another, you know, set of evidence or draw my attention to any new evidence which proves anything that I'm telling you is wrong, you know. So I'm open to it if it's there, but I haven't seen anybody say it. In fact, I've seen quite the reverse. All I've seen are multiple attacks on Dr. Judy Wood, on her character, on her book, on her website, on me. I mean, for example, if you go and read one of the reviews of my book, one of the reviews says, for my book that I give away free in electronic versions, it says free is too much. Free is too much. It actually says that. So this is what you're dealing with, you see. This is the level of resistance that is within people that are not supposed to be skeptical or are supposed to be open-minded.
Well, if the faction that's out there that wants all this covered up, it would behoove them to discredit anybody that comes anywhere near it. And you got to remember that things like 911, a lot of people are not aware of this on a conscious level, I don't think. I mean, I could be wrong. Right. That basically events like 911 or the Israeli war that's going on over there between them and Palestine, all of this stuff can be used for mind control, to manipulate people through their emotions by stirring up their anger toward the target they want it stirred up toward.
You're absolutely right, and this is one of the problems with dealing with 9/11 as an issue. And I, you know, I found, for example, that people in the 9/11, this is going back a few years, it's slightly different now, but when I was posting stuff on a forum in the UK, 9/11 UK forum, they didn't really want to talk about UFOs and aliens and, you know, and this sort of thing. And then free energy, they didn't really want to talk about that. A few people want to talk about free energy, but, you know, I heard another guy last night. He was talking about free energy. I was watching a YouTube video from a couple of weeks ago, and he was going on about Tesla and the technology and how it was all covered up and kept under wraps. And then they talked about weaponization of the technologies, and the host asked him, well, do you think that's why it's been covered up? Because they're afraid somebody will weaponize it, you know. And this guy says, well, yeah, you know, I think there's an element of that, definitely. And I thought,
not only that, if people finally, you know, know it works and learn how to install it, they're out of business.
It's already happened. Well, that as well, of course, the economic factors, but the weaponization has already been done. We can prove that. It's not theoretical. We know that that's what's happened. So, I tried to contact the guy. I contacted him, I think, yesterday or the day before. You know, these free energy researchers, they won't talk about 9/11. But if they're going to be beetling away with their projects, and they don't understand why when they get to a certain point, you know, they're going to get the guys in black cars coming in, smashing up their labs, you know, in midnight and burning them down. They need to understand why that is happening. Else, you know, all the effort they put in for these decades is going to go to waste, because it's never going to go anywhere. You know, so people have to understand that this technology has already been weaponized, you know, and it's been used. it's not a theory anymore. So this idea, anybody that says, oh yeah, well, we can't really declassify this because it might be used by terrorists, it's already happened. It's already been done. The technology has been classified, and by the people who classified it, they've already turned it into a weapon, and they've already used it. And they've probably used it more than once as well, not just on 9/11. You know, we've got a few other question marks about other events that we've looked at, but none with as much evidence as 9/11.
Right.
So,
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just going to say, so let's get over that hurdle. Let's, you know, we know that that's true now. So what are we going to do about it? Let's not just debate whether it is true or not, because we know that it's true. Let's move on. What are we going to do about it? You know, see what I mean? That,
right.
You've got to go through that point to effect change.
That's true. Now, I also wanted to get a moment in here before they start the music, which I'm hoping they will start soon, since I got something I need to do in a minute.
Okay.
But I wanted to get your website in there one more time. www.checktheevidence.co.uk/CMS. Or you can go to www.checktheevidence.com, can't they?
Yeah, that's right. Both of those will work. Yeah, the same.
And then there's www.drjudywood.com if you want to learn more about her. And she's got a lot of information on her site. And also, and I put these links in the chat room earlier, the one to John Hutchins, which was www.hutchins1effect.ca.
Ah, right. Let me tell you about
Hutchins
that.
Hutchins effect, I'm sorry, .ca.
No, let me tell you about that. That site has been hijacked by somebody.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's got a lot of information on it, which is okay. But that site was essentially stolen from John a few years ago. And there's a story, I write about that a little bit in my book, I think.
There goes that music.
I'll just quickly give that, www.thehutchinseneffect.com. That's
okay.
The one to go to.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate that. And I want to thank you for coming on my show. It's been a real pleasure to interview you. And I hope that we can do this again in the future.
Absolutely, Royce. Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And good luck with your health, basically.
Oh, I thank you. I appreciate that. And also, if you would, hang loose by the Skype for a few minutes. I'm going to send you a Skype message. Somebody wants to get a hold of you to be on their show, but I have to do something before I can do that.
No problem.
Okay, talk to you later. Goodbye, everybody. Come back and see me next Thursday at this time. Y'all be good.